Okay, so welcome everyone to our virtual machines lecture today. I hope you used the time that you had for familiarizing yourself a little bit more with what Prolog actually is. So let's maybe try to recall the examples from yesterday. So the basic idea was to have kind of a database of facts that are specified in terms of implications. And then there is a query that you can put out there that then tries to somehow deduce whether this query is actually valid at all, and if so, then the system usually tries to provide you with an example of how to unify the expression, the clause that you have given within your query with the specifications from above by giving you bindings to the variables that you have had in your query. And yeah, so this is kind of the idea behind the specification. So in that sense, you provide a logical puzzle to the machine. The machine is supposed to, or the program is supposed to find out what the solution to this puzzle is, in kind of solving this puzzle. And this is actually exactly the idea that is behind the translation of such a program. The idea is to generate a program that is trying to solve this particular riddle. And the technique that it follows by that is not particularly random one as the one that we have tried out last time for just getting a kind of an intuition of the thing, but a rather systematic one with a lot of trial and error. And in case that the program happens to do a mistake and realizes that there is a mistake, it would try to undo its last choice that it did and backtrack to a position from before and do another choice. In that sense, it tries to explore all the possibilities that it has for trying to solve this logical puzzle. And the way that this would work is that first of all, it tries from the structure that the program has to come up with certain correspondences to from this specification to things that we can that remind us of what a procedural program is all about. So let's maybe have a focus first on how you how the structure of a program is actually like. And yeah, so these are the pieces that make up a Prolog program. So the most basic components of a Prolog program are the so-called terms within this T production, and this can be, well, basic values, which are just, well, uninterpreted atoms in that sense. We have had the convention of keeping them lowercase, and apart from that, just like what we were used to as identifiers, but this is now a value for this system, so we call that an atom. Then there's variables. They have a similar pattern, except that they are uppercase, so the first letter has to be uppercase. Apart from that, the it looks the same as the atom, this is considered to be a variable and can be bound to particular particular atoms, or, well, basically terms, and well, same way it can be kept free if it doesn't contribute to solving the logical riddle. Then you might encounter these underscores being anonymous variables for which we don't have any further use. This might come in handy if you're not particularly interested in a certain position within a composed term. So that's the anonymous variable. And then we come to the composed terms. They usually consist of a constructor application, like the constructor being mentioned in front of the brackets, and then you have a combination of other terms that make up this particular structure. So those are all considered to be like basic value things that you can then find throughout other structural elements of the whole thing. Then what you also find is that apart from just basic values, you have usually the parts that come to the right of these clause things, which had either been these equalities that are usually meant to denote that with this we mean that there needs to be a unification of what the variable is meant to be, if it has a meaning so far, if there is anything bound to that, and the term on the other side of the equality. So this is a unification clause, unification thing here. And the other thing that you might find as a structural component is what you see here. This is a predicate call. So, yeah, this usually also appears on, well, these right-hand sides of these clauses. So each of those two you call a goal, and they can occur on the right-hand side of clauses, while whereas on the left-hand side you find again, as with these predicate calls, you find predicate names and lists of formal parameters, usually in this same notation as the variables. And yeah, the right part of this clause is considered to be the body of this clause, and this is a sequence of goals in that sense. So this is a sequence of unifications and predicate calls. Now, if you have several of them, you can combine them together with another goal into an actual prolog program. So the first collection of clauses is that what we have baptized the database last time. And then there is a single goal, which is the query to this collection of clauses. So this is what the structure is officially named as. And yeah, with that, we're going to continue throughout the whole thing. So I promised you that we would find some kind of equivalence between what we have, a structure of a prolog program, program, and procedural programs. So, in that sense, what are the correspondences? Well, we had something that we called predicates. These predicates are somewhat the equivalent of, in our programming world, of a procedure is. clauses serve as definitions for such procedures. Literals predicate calls in that sense can be interpreted like procedure calls. And if you then just look at these three components so far, you might have noticed that we had in our examples before several clauses that were talking about one particular predicate. So there seems to be multiple definitions for the same predicate, thus also for the same procedure. So what does that mean for our understanding in terms of the programming world? Well, if these literals are procedure calls and we have several definitions of them, what could that mean? No idea? Well, there's choice, which of the clauses will I actually select?
The first one matches.
And the others, if they match too?
So they're the first one and the first one.
So, priority-based system. Well, in terms of practical Prolog semantics in that sense, there will probably be something like a strategy like trying just the first one that matches. What matches means is, on the other hand, not so clear. You would have to start interpreting the right-hand side of these things already, so the bodies of these things. But in general, there is just no clear way to select those things. So in that sense, it's just a non-deterministic model that we have there. So we could choose any of those. We could choose to try them out just in top-down fashion. So just use the first one. And in your words, the first one that matches would be, we would just try out and see how far we can go in our semantics by continuing with the procedure calls or predicate calls that we find in there, and if we happen to encounter failure at some point, don't know yet what a failure is, but this choice can at some point fail, then we would just backtrack one step until we have again a point where we were able to choose, where there was a point of non-determinism, and choose another option. So it's just a kind of a brute force exploration of all the non-deterministic choices until we find one combination of choices that will lead to success. And if we don't find such a thing, then we will at some point have looked through all possible choices, so explored the whole decision space, and if there's no successful predicate call sequence in there that will lead to non-failure, then this is just failing the whole query to the thing. So, yeah, that's that. Let's maybe continue a little bit. We had said that these term things are the very basic things that serve as facts or values in our world. So this is what the terms are. And then what we have is these other things that we find on the right-hand side of a predicate definition or a clause, apart from just predicate calls, which would be these unification things, so these equalities with left and right hand side, and those actually do some work. So they serve for, well, just comparing the structure of the things and providing bindings to variables that are necessary in order to make the two sides of the equality actually really equal. So this is what gives us binding to variables, which is kind of a side effect of such a computation step. Apart from that, the unification just has two results, either success or failure. And with this failure thing, we now have the criterion for when we have to backtrack again. If we come to a point where unification says, well, based on the structure that we found there and the binding that we have had so far to our variables, we can't successfully unify these two things, then this is a failure, and this will be carried back to a point where we had a non-deterministic choice, and we will undo the choice that we have done and all the steps that followed that, and just choose differently, and for example, try out another right-hand side of a predicate call of a predicate definition, and with that, in that sense, just brute force our way through all these definitions, and hope that at some point we find a successful unification, and with that, an example binding that will fulfill the query together with a collection of clauses. So that is what you get. It's not a unique solution, but it is a solution to that particular query together with the clauses that form our knowledge base. So that is the general concept that we will follow in the next few slides in order to give a semantics to a product program. And in order to do so, well, if we have such a structure, like we create procedure calls, for that we usually need, of course, an instruction store, something where we store whatever these procedures should do. So as we have done before with all the other virtual machines, we usually start with a code store like the one that we see here, which is not particularly unusual. It's what we have seen before. It is comes with a program counter and starts at zero, and this just is storing our usual instructions. Furthermore, since we have things like procedure calls, or we'll have something like that, we will probably at some point nest procedure calls and try to evaluate them. And for that, we usually need something that is able to deal with this nesting. And that is usually a stack. And so again, for our purposes, we need a runtime stack with a stack pointer and a frame pointer, the usual components that we use for procedure call. So that is not too unusual. Then maybe the last thing, the heap. Where does the heap come into play for our purposes? Well, this might not be particularly obvious at first, but during the evaluation of our query, we will have to at some point construct the structures that that we find within either unifications or actual parameters and all that. So there was this complicated structure that you could introduce by nesting terms, atoms, and variables. And these things we will see that we don't want to have on the stack itself, but instead we will just keep references to those things on the stack in order to keep things manageable, and instead construct them on the heap and keep the actual values, the atoms of these systems, just on the heap. And it happens that for the way that we evaluate these queries, the way in which these structures develop is usually similar to what we have usually as a stack. We won't use the heap in a random fashion, but in a coordinated way, so we can also have a heap pointer, and the heap just grows and shrinks depending on what we do there. So that is for the heap. So we have stack-like structure for the heap with a heap pointer, and we will allocate the basic objects of our language prod there, and this means that we have to somehow manage the objects that we put on this heap, and that's what we see over here. This is an overview on all the different kinds of objects of the heap. So what makes up the structure usually? Well, there's these basic components, basic entities that we put in there. So there's, for example, the atom. So it's just an interpreted basic value. This just consists in the ID or name for that particular atom. And apart from that, just the marker that this is indeed an atom. The other things that we found to be there was a variable, and variables in our world usually exist, well, either as variables that have at some point been unified already with some other value or variable, whatever we have had as history. So we usually use that to point to some other thing. And so we have a marker, like there, for a reference. And then the second part serves as an address or index in the heap where this variable points to. And if this is a thing that is bound to a basic value, then, for example, this points to an atom. If that is unified with another variable, then this usually points to another reference thingy, which by itself can then also point to an atom at some point, or if it is not bound yet and still free to be bound to anything else, then this is, well, just signified in our diagrams with this self loop thing, but this is just not a valid pointer so far. The last thing that can live on the heap is structure. Remember, there's these constructor things that could combine several parameters to, in context of a particular name. So this is this structure here that is marked with an S, carries with it the actual name of the of the constructor, its arity, and then the actual parameters for that constructor. So this is then a structure. So these are all the things that we find on the heap. So now that we know what resides on the heap, we might be interested in the way that we can actually construct such terms on the heap. And this is what we usually do or need to do in order to pass around the parameter values. And we usually just do that via references from the stack to the heap, where on the heap then we have the sophisticated build-ups of these basic structures. So, the address environment for our programs then, this row thing, will then for the variables that are used within a clause will map to specific cells on the stack relative to the frame pointer. So this resides somewhere in the frame of a particular clause, so of a particular predicate. There are some variables that make it into the parameter part, so it will be somewhere on one side of the frame pointer, and then there will be local variables just for that particular clause that are introduced on right-hand sides of clauses and are similar just locally for this combination of goals. So these are ones that shouldn't make it into this parameter list, because they are not the same for each of these clauses. So they are usually reside on the other side of where the frame pointer points to. Anyway, these are managed in the address environment and consist of cells on the stack, which find their values on the actual heap and refer to the address where these values start. And in order to construct these values on the heap, we introduce this code generation scheme code A, which serves for creating the address of such a heap term on the stack, and the term for which to create a representation on the heap is given as parameter. And that is that. So how do we do that? Well, it's what we find living in this T is a term that is consists of constructors with parameters that can themselves be constructors or atoms or variables. So this gives rise to something which is already quite similar to what a tree structure usually is. So we can interpret this thing like its syntactical tree, and in order to create a representation of that on the heap, we will have to come up with a linearization of such a tree. And there's several ways of doing that. One way is by traversing this tree in a depth-first manner and interpret the particular events that happen through while we do the traversal, and we specify which events we interpret by giving this this particular term here, which is this post-order thing. So each time that we leave a particular substructure of this tree, we trigger on a particular event. So usually this is then the creation of a subpart of the representation. So what we will then do is we will run through the syntax tree of such a term, and each time that we leave a particular substructure, we will then put something on the heap. So for an example, obviously that this will come on the next slide. So this is the example that we're going to look into. So there's constructors involved, like this F and G. There's variables X, Y, and Z, and then atom A. And what we get as additional information is that we can emanate from the state that X is already initialized at some earlier stage. So there in the stack frame's representation for that variable, there is already a valid reference for this thing. So in FP plus whatever the address environment for X gives, there is already a reference. However, Y and Z have not been initialized yet. So for those, we need some kind of fresh representation. So let's have a look at how this works out. So this is the term again. And let's see what such a post-order traversal through that thing will actually really give us. So maybe it's time for thinking about how this thing is represented as in terms of a syntax tree-like thing. So this is usually what a syntax tree of such a thing looks like. So constructors usually are the parents for a particular subtree, and the children are the parameters to that constructor, which can nest together to build some, up something like this. So what then is supposed to happen is that we do the first run through that thing. That first run will first descend, then here go back up, ascend back to this thing while triggering in post order, meaning here happens something, then we re-descend again, ascend again while triggering here, re-ascend here, having dealt with G, triggering again, visiting the next child, leaving that, triggering again, leaving that, triggering, and then triggering for this thing. So this gives us the sequence 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Can you actually read that here? I might just repeat that in red. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this is the sequence in which those fellows here are visited in post order at first traversal. So this is also the sequence in which the creation of the corresponding heap representations is happening. So let's look at those. So the first thing that needs to happen is the representation for this variable X. So for variables, we will usually create things like these reference thingies. This is what we have seen in our heap object overview. So this is an R thing. And since X is already initialized, this will point to whatever the representation on the stack would yield as a reference. So this points to the same thing. With that, we are done for X. This can then continues with this whatever we have to do for Y. This will create another reference on the heap, and this one is uninitialized. We said everything apart from X is uninitialized, so this will just create a self loop like this one and nothing more. So that's that. And with that, we continue with event 3 being a structure, G needing to be created on the heap. So for that, we will then put this thing on the heap that is supposed to then point to, well, whatever has been found being referred to on the stack, on the top of the stack, which is the reference that we have created before, and what we have found beneath that as its two parameters. So this is how we create the representation for this GXY part. And we continue with our scheme, like the creation of the representation for A, which is as an atom. We can already finalize that in this form. So this is just an A object by itself. The reference to that resides down on the stack above the representation, the reference to the structure G. Then we leave that and continue with 5, which is another reference thing, uninitialized, so it's a self loop. So this one is ending up on the stack as well. And now we continue with this event 6. So this is another constructor for an F term, and this has 3 parameters. So we take the 3 topmost cells of the stack, put them into the fields that belong to the structure here, and name it appropriately, and then refer from the push down to this thing by its start address. And this will be the outcome of the generation of this heap value. So we end up with 1 reference on top of the stack, of the runtime stack, that points to the structure object that then internally points to other components that it has, if it has some, and so on until we reach things like atoms or self-references. Okay, so it's not overly complicated, I would say. It's just like you have to know that there's this this step first run through that thing. So how can we support that with virtual machine routines? So first of all, the situation of something being already initialized and some other things not being already initialized is actually a real situation that we have to deal with. And so far, we maybe not know directly where this comes from. Side remark, it has to do with argument passing. And usually, if you have an argument to a predicate, then this has been called somewhere else in goal, for example. So at that point, there already has been a unification made of some other value and the formal parameter of that thing. So there is already some kind of binding out there. So these things are usually already initialized in some way. But of course, since within goals you can have common variables that are not present in the parameters of a predicate, these are your local variables, and they usually are not always initialized, at least. So in order to signify whether we are talking about an initialized variable or an uninitialized variable, we will introduce just a marker on variables in order to just flag this thing as being already initialized or not. So this is why we put this little line on top of that. So now we can talk about what we have to do for each component of a syntax tree of a term that we find. And well, turns out that we can kind of deal with just these events in the post order depth first traversal of the syntax tree of that thing by, well, just giving a code A for the leaves of this thing, like for an atom. We introduce this put atom with the actual name, what the atom is. Then we can happen to trigger at a uninitialized variable. For this, we will introduce this put var thing like this with as a parameter, it's well supposed to be offset in the frame, which is given to us by row x. Then there's this x prime, which is therefore the already initialized variable, which is then instead of creating a new variable thing, which will put a reference on there to some other thing. And yeah, that's that. Then there is the anonymous variable, which we will just treat with a put anon. We are not depending on any reference later on to that thing, so we don't need any index into the frame, so that's good. And well, finally, then there is the way that we treat the term constructor here, and for that we will first create the code for the terms, so code A of T1 to TN, and then do a put struct of FN, which will then work with all the references that we have created on the stack for T1 to TN, put them into the components of FN, and then just keep the reference to FN. So this, by this structure here, with working with a T1 to TN and then putting the structure using this put structure FN, we implicitly do this post-order traversal by first descending into what the code for T1 to TN is, and then providing what this local contribution to the data structure is after everything else. So this is what the post-order thing does. So as an example, I think this is the one that was on the slide before. So this is now with our formalization of the initialized variable x here and the actual address environment that tells us about the location within the frame. So we will at first do the code generation for the complete f thing, which will do a put struct of f at the end, and then do code A things for each of its parameters, which will be this, this, and this. So this z corresponds to a variable, or is a variable, so this corresponds to putvar, and z is associated with 3, so this is a putvar 3. A is an atom, so this is just put atom of whatever has been the atom, which is A for our purposes, and then the first parameter had been another structure thing, so we, for that, we put the put structure at the end, and then deal with both of its parameters. First of all, the put var for this y thing, which is associated with 2, so that is why there's put var 2. And then there's x, which is overlined, and this means that this is already initialized, so we will switch to put ref instead of put var. Okay, so this is just stupidly inlining what these code generation schemes do, but what is the semantics of each of these things? So let's maybe start with a simple one, which is this put atom A. So for this, we have seen in our intuitive example that we need to create just a simple atom object, and that's what we do, and we refer to that on top of the pushdown. In case of where we have to deal with an uninitialized variable, we have already space in our frame, which serves as the space for the variable. It can be reached through the index I relative to the frame pointer, but it is uninitialized yet. So there is no valid reference in there. So what we do with put var is We will initialize that with not known value at that point. So this is this new reference object that we create here, which refers to itself. But this is now pointed to from now on from this cell in the frame. So from now on, we consider this cell to be initialized. And in order to work with that reference later on to build up more complex structures, we also need a pointer to this reference on top of the pushdown. So that's this one here. Put anon is this underscore thingy, which you have seen in there. This might be necessary for reasons, because you might need to at some point unify two structures, but are not actually interested in the how a particular component of a structure looks like. So you put an underscore there. This corresponds to, well, you don't want to name it anymore in the in the future. You can just immediately forget about that. That is why you don't have to keep this reference pointed to from the frame of the function. You just need it temporarily for computations of unifications. Thus, you create a reference on top of the pushdown pointing to a yet not valid reference, but don't point to the reference from anywhere in the frame. So this is this put anon thingy. Then we have the situation of an already initialized variable. So this one starts off with variables specified with I, which already points to something valid on the heap. And with putref, we act in a similar way as we have done for putvar. We construct a situation where the frame's cell points to the same thingy as the top of the pushdown, but now we already have had a valid thing to point to from the start, so we don't need to create a new one. So this is the only difference between putvar and putref. So, yeah, maybe as a side note, in the implementation of the virtual machine, you see this deref being called before we assign the value of the frames, or well, the reference is stored in the frames cell, and this serves for kind of resolving sequences of references that would otherwise be created if we would just point to whatever that is. So this tries to follow all the references that are created via these R things, and until we reach the final actual non-reference kind of heap object. And in that sense, we kind of resolve these types of chains of references. And this is just given as this implementation here. This deref on a particular heap object reference will just in case that there is this thing refers to another reference object, this will just point to whatever this is referring to instead of the original reference object, and continue to dereference on whatever this is. And if that that is at some point no reference thing anymore, this won't match anymore. Same as if you reach a non-valid reference, then this will also not match anymore. In that case, we'll just return the actual address that we have found with that. And with this, we will just go to the end of such a chain of reference things and use that as our target where we refer to on top of the stack. Okay, So, then there's only the last thing missing, which is this put struct fn, which is then just a way of building a new construct application representation object on the heap. And yeah, so there is n many, so the arity of the f is given here as n, so n many references to heap things already on the runtime stack, and they need to be packed into a new constructor representation. So we just loop for n times over the top of the push down and put everything into the newly created heap object, and then remove everything from top of the stack and just keep the new reference on top of that. So with that, we can successfully do this representation on the heap. Yeah. So, yeah, we have talked about this putref thing and these reference chains already. Maybe a thing that you have realized, but maybe not. So in these constructed terms, what will usually happen is that if we introduce a reference, it might point to something. And by the way that these constructions develop over time, this usually means that references can only either exist as not valid references or references to something that has existed before. And since this heap is growing at some point, this usually means that this refers to an address which has been created before, thus being smaller as the current address that we are handling. So references usually point to smaller heap addresses. However, we won't be able to keep that up completely for the rest of the generation scheme, but for now we can emanate from that. So, literals now. These are the one possible goal for a predicate definition. So, serves as a component for what we use as a predicate body, and literal is in that sense the building block that corresponds to a predicate or procedure call in that sense. So we are looking now at how to perform procedure calls, and yeah, what we know already. That what we need to use for that is that we usually need to allocate some kind of stack frame for that. We need to deal with actual parameters. We have seen how to build up structures on the heap already, so this might come in handy for implementing these literals. And of course, we receive access to these constructed parameters as references on the stack frame, where we then use them to bake them into the new stack frame and can jump to whatever we deem appropriate for handling this particular literal or predicate call. So for that, we will need to jump to some code that deals with that. And in that sense, we will have something similar to a procedure call. So, literals, we have said, look like these things. So this is code G, so the code generation for goals. And the code generation for a predicate call goal, will look like very much like a procedure call. So there's usually the generation of the management part of stack frame done with this mark. We have seen that several times by now, so Same here, we will do a mark that creates backups of management registers and puts the continuation address B in the stack frame. And then what we need is the addresses of the data elements, the addresses of the actual parameter representations that we get with these code A calls of all the parameters T1 to TK, and then we complement that with a call instruction for the predicate of array TK. So that's that. It already looks quite similar to what we have seen for other languages. So let's maybe dive right into an example of how to do that. So this is now a predicate on some actual parameters. So how do we translate that? We will first of all have to create a stack frame for that. So we do a mark with a continuation address of whatever comes behind. We will have to do a call to said predicate. So this P goes in there and it has three parameters. So this is going here. And then we deal with each of the parameters code A generation. So this will create representations on the heap and give us references on the pushdown for that. So first of all, parameter A will be handled with a put atom A. Then we have to deal with X, for which we have address environment 1. So what that will do is it is non-overlined, so this is a new variable that has to be initialized. So this is put var of the index 1. Then we have the next parameter, which has to be assembled before it can be actually used as a reference thingy. So we will do that by first of all appending the put struct at the end of that for G. And before that, we have to create the heap representations of its children. So this is X overlined, which is a valid reference already. So put ref of 1. And a new variable Y, which is mapped to 2. So this is put var 2. And notice, this overline thing is quite a convenient thing. Here we're starting with X being an uninitialized variable, but later on there was another occurrence of X. So X has been already seen twice in a term here. So the first time, when it was new and not known so far, we could emanate from the situation that this is not initialized so far. So this, there it was non-overlined. Later on, we met it a second time, and since we have already created code for that thing before, this is now known and initialized, and this time we will have to put the overline on that. So that's kind of the idea that is behind that. This overline thing is just, in that sense, a helper that gives you an idea of what you have seen so far and whatnot. Okay, so this is just plain plain application of this code generation scheme on the example. To give you an overview on the stack frame of the Vim, this is, well, probably not particularly surprising. So we have the frame pointer, which points to a lot of organizational cells. So there we do the management of whatever can happen at runtime. There is a backup of the frame pointer somewhere inside. there is grayed out parts of the organizational cells, which is room for things that we have not yet introduced but will be necessary in order to do something. And there's a thing that is called postcont. What could that be? Considering that we have already talked about how exceptions have been done in the MAMA, there has been this concept of a positive continuation and a negative continuation. So post-cont already sounds a lot like a positive continuation. And, well, for these exceptions, there was two outcomes of how execution or, well, evaluation of an expression could work out. Here, for our solver, there's also this notion of trying out something, and if it fails, we have to go a different route. So this is also happening here. We have same means of dealing with that, with a positive continuation, and later on there will also be a negative continuation. But so far we can lay back and ignore the negative part and just be positive so far, and yeah, just put in the positive continuation address in here, and we'll deal with the other part later on. Then there is the actual parameters, which should usually be found right above the whole thing, like this. And then these will probably also be extended by whatever is found as local variables occurring in the sequence of goals of a particular clause. So yeah, this is what is found in this pink part, and then there's some rest of local stack. So this is how the stack frame of the Vim will look like. Positive continuation address we have already talked about. Then there's a short overview here, like what we do with the other things, and we have said that there is this notion of negative continuation whenever something has failed. This means that we will have to do backtracking, and for backtracking we will need a little bit of information additional or more than we have needed before for things like resetting bindings that we have introduced before. So there's other things that we might need, but for now, for just introducing the first part of positively just exploring, we will gray that out and look at that later on. So knowing that, what Mark will do then is that we'll just create the space that we need on the stack by reserving space for six cells, with the positive continuation here being filled with the address that is given to Mark, which is the continuation after the procedure call in that sense. And the other thing that it can already do is it takes the value from the frame pointer and enters it in the second position in the frame. And everything else we keep unknown so far. So that is what Mark does for our purposes. Then, conceptually, we will have the address generation for all the parameters of a procedure call. For that, we already have the code generation scheme, code A, and then we will continue with the actual call. So that's what we have this call PN for. And this will then perform the actual call to the predicate by, well, the address which to call will then be the one associated with PN. So for that we will have a valid address where the code for the thing will be stored. And the frame pointer then was it set before? No, it had been still the way. This has now this now has to be set to its actual top of the organizational cells, and we can find them n cells beneath the top of the stack. So that's where this n is for. Okay. Good. Next thing, in terms of goals, there was not only literals, but instead there is the concept of unification. So there is these little equalities there, not so little anymore if you have more sophisticated examples. And they consist in these equalities with left-hand side, right-hand side, and what you would do is you would try to match them together, which is called the unification, and you will, while doing that, you might either notice that it's not possible to unify them, resulting in failure, or you will, without any effort, be able to see that they are already the same, then this will just succeed. Or you will see that, well, on one side there is there's just a variable, so this part of the structure has not yet been determined. And on the other side, there is already a known way of how to complete this structure, so in order to make them to unify them, you need to fix this free part where there's just a variable to have the same shape as the other side where there is already some kind of structure present. So there you will create a binding, and this is what this unification will roughly do. So a few side things as a convention beforehand, where there is another flag for variables. So there, we will have this little wave thingy with which we denote an occurrence of X in some term, and depending on whether the variable is initialized or not, this will lead to a different interpretation in terms of what this put macro then will be. So a generic occurrence of X will then either be inlined into a put var, a put ref, or a put anon, depending on this x being either uninitialized, initialized, or even anonymous. So, yeah, that is different notions to that, and they will just dispatch to different instructions like this put var, put anon, or put ref. So, yeah, this x. X wave thing will just be mapping to those. So, how to now translate a particular unification goal? Well, the straightforward way of doing that is probably to push a reference to X or whatever X is bound to onto the stack. So we don't care at that point on the case distinction. So just put the right instruction depending on what X has been bound to so far on there. And then with that residing on the stack, what we will then do is we have already put this part on the stack, then we, in order to somehow match them, we will then need to put T on there. So what we do is we will construct whatever T is on the heap, which will with this code A part just result in another reference to a heap object that corresponds to T. So then we have two references on top of the stack. And then what would be a good idea is maybe to just invent a new instruction that says now we have to kind of find out how they match with each other in terms of unification and introduce some facility within the virtual machine to do so. So that is what we are actually going to do. So the goal code generation for such a unification is, first of all, put of whatever this variable corresponds to, together with the reference to whatever term is given on the other side of the equation, and then just perform the unification in terms of sophisticated algorithm in the virtual machine. So what that means for an example is that we can just stupidly apply the code generation scheme for the goal that we find here. So this is this goal here, which consists first on of a left-hand side, which is this overlined U, meaning U is an initialized reference. U is also associated with 4, so this will result in a put ref 4. Then we will have a complicated structure to create in the heap, which will be done in that part. And then the last part of the thing will be the unification, which will be represented in this thing. So for our example, the large green box then consists in the code that generates the term on the pushdown, but this one we have already seen earlier on. This is the example from before, which is just this put struct F on a variable, an atom, and another structure consisting of G and variable and a reference. So this is this one and this one. Yeah?
So in relation to the real for whatever program, so what is the difference between here where we use the put struct always and where we have the procedure call?
These F and G things won't be found as any predicates somewhere. So they are never occurring on left-hand sides of clauses. So they are just considered to be like constants. And yeah, they're just used to make up more complicated structures. So it's good. So this is just the kind of stupid application of the code generation scheme. We have made our life easy by delegating everything to Unify, of course. So what's Unify? It's supposed to take the topmost two cells, we have said, which are considered to be references to heap objects, and in general, we suppose them to be some value on the heap that might overlap in its structure a little bit. But afterwards, when we have performed the unification on those, we will have come up with a common representation that matches both things while filling in values for free variable parts of these structures so that both of them match with each other in their structure, and With that, we just consume everything that is on top of a thing. We are not really interested in, well, it can either fail or succeed, but nothing else. But there's no return thing to put on the pushdown, because we will either continue with the continuation address for the positive case or for the negative case. So there's nothing produced on top of the stack. But instead, what will happen throughout this thing is we might have side effects of performing this unification in terms of determining new values for variables. And this is happening in things that are pointed to somewhere in the stack frame like this. So this is how we transport information for what has happened through this unification. Okay, so what unify is supposed to do is takes two heap addresses, beforehand we will have to guarantee that they are maximally dereferenced, but this is a thing that we have tried to take care of during the generation of these reference things, for example, with this deref thing. And the easy case, what this unification should do is, of course, well, if the addresses that are pointed to are already identical, then this is easy. We can just terminate in positive continuation. Or if there is variables there that are not bound yet, well, we will just bind the younger variables to older variables by just referring from one to the other. If one already refers to a term, we will have to do some checks. If the other one is free, then it's fine. We can just refer from one to the other. If the other one also contains a term, then we will have to go into the structure of each of these terms that are pointed to and piecewise repeat this unification process. And return whatever this piecewise unification will give us, and also probably binding a variable to a term where the variable is already in use is probably a bad idea. This would just create non-valid equality in that sense. So therefore, we maybe also need some way of doing occurrence checks in there. If we do this unification of two structures recursively in that sense, we will, while we do that, maybe come up with new bindings. We will have to record those in a particular way so that we can undo them in case the whole thing fails at some point. So for now, we will highlight the spots where these records will be taken. We won't really go into detail here for now how this undoing will be done, but first of all, we'll focus on how we come up with new bindings in that sense. And, well, lastly, the whole thing can also fail, and then we will start with the backtracking process, which we will at this point only call but not really see how it works in detail, just one piece after one piece at a time in that sense. So let's focus on what this unify process is, and this is a two-pager, so bear with me. So unify works on two references obtained from top of the stack, points to points to the heap, and we said there's easy cases, for example, when the pointed to things are equal in terms of address. This is the first case here. In that case, we don't have to do anything, we can just return true. So this is nice. Next thing is what happens if the heap thing for reference U consists of an unbound reference. this is nice. This would probably not lead to a fail because it's still unbound. There is room to match up with the other part. So far, so good. Then if the other reference is also an unbound reference, well, that's a nice case. We don't have to care a lot apart from just linking them together in the sense that one reference now is not a self-reference anymore but has to point to the other one. And we said we want to keep up ordering such that we always point to the smaller address. So all that remains to do is we need to compare the addresses and then modify the larger addressed reference to point to the lower addressed reference. So that is what we do with these assignments, and then we will also add information to the undo log, so to say, with some unspecified method trail, which will just register that we have manipulated this U. And apart from that, we will just return true because we have done our matching for these cases. What else is there to do? Well, if this is the case, this else if thing is now the case for whenever the first reference had been an uninitialized reference and the other one has been something else. Well, in that case, this is also still nice enough because we can still point from one to the other. The only thing that we have to do is to check whether the reference is also mentioned in the other structure at some point, because this will create this kind of non-valid structures. So we need to perform this check thing here, and if that goes through, then we can just point from U to V. So U doesn't occur within the structure in V, so we can just point from U to V, keep track of our modifications, and return true. And if it turns out that the check had been negative, in the sense that U actually occurs within F, then, oh, that's a bad thing. We have to backtrack and also return false. So all that has been cases for when the first reference had been a variable that had not been bound yet. Now we are in the cases where the first thing is not an unbound variable, but it might still be that the second variable is still unbound, so other way around. This can also happen, and for that we do a similar part as we have done here, so checking whether it occurs on in the other term, and react accordingly. So the check we do here, and then we just continue as we have done before with setting this whole thing and do a protocol of what we have changed. Otherwise, we do backtrack and return false. After this thing, we have made sure that neither of the references is either the same or a variable that is unbound yet or uninitialized yet. So what can happen here now? Well, another nice case is if, for example, we are not pointing to the same address, but the atom happens to be still the same, for example. So in case that we point to atoms, the nice case is the one where both of them are pointing to a similar atom. This can happen through atoms being mentioned several times in terms, and that way we have several representations of atoms in the heap, and this is how we can just react to that. We don't need to bind anything, so we can simply return true. Nice one. So the last somewhat nice part is then what is what is remaining? Well, the case of structures. So when are structures in both references nice ones? They are nice ones if they are pointing to the same kind of structure in terms of the same constructor being used. So if both of them have the same constructor, then there's still a chance of both the references being able to be unified or matched to each other. And yeah, so this is an, the precondition. The constructor needs to be the same. And now it just remains to be seen whether all the parameters for the constructors are still the same. So what we essentially do is we loop on all the parameters from 1 to n, and then just delegate to another call of unify. And this time we do that on the parameters from either reference, so u plus I or v plus I, depending on one reference or the other. And we emanate from completely dereferenced versions of whatever is stored there. So there we do the normalization and go to the end of reference chains in that sense. And yeah, if it turns out that either of those unification processes is failing, thus returns false, then of course also this instance of unify will return false. So this, apart from that, we assume that backtrack has already been called in these base cases that we have seen earlier, so we don't need to do backtracking once again. And yeah, after that has been dealt with, every other case that can happen is a case where we have found something that will lead to invalid unifications. So there's, for example, atoms matching up with structures, or yeah, that's or atoms matching up with different atoms, and this is usually a thing where we just can immediately backtrack and fail. So this is this other return false here. I hope this was not too overwhelming, because it's a two-pager, and this already exceeds the usual short-time memory, but at least for me. But I hope you could follow a little bit. If not, would be advisable to look at that again at home, because we're gonna work out a little bit more on details later on by moving a few of these runtime things into code generation parts in order to not having to do so much in runtime. So anyway, there's also still an example of two unification processes. Well, no, of one unification process given as these two data structures on the heap. And just give you an idea of how unification would work out here. So our initial points here are, entry points are here and here. So unification on this will immediately start inspecting what is referred to from our initial things, and this is for both of them structures. So this is already not too bad. Also, the constructor names are the same. So far, this is already nice. It now depends on whether the parameters of the constructors are matching up. So there's a new unification processes spawned on, for example, those two fellows here, and they are spawned on not directly what is referred to, but on the dereferenced version of that, meaning we go chains of references till we finally reach the terminating element, which is for the upper part this one, for the lower part this one, and call unification process again. So unify on those two red fellows here will give us, well, the first one is not an uninitialized reference, but the second one is. This is always a good thing, because we can then easily create a unified version by changing this thing so that it points to its counterpart. So this reference then will, instead of being an uninitialized version, refer to the atom A. And with that, the thing returns true, and we can go back to the calling part, which is our original unify, which then still needs to, oh man, had to happen at some point. Four minutes before the end. Oh yeah. So these two references here need to be unified. Again, they are dereferenced until the latest thing here. So these are the ones to unify, and convention is that we have to unify by pointing from the larger address to the lower address. So this is the unification that is done. So I think, yeah, this is animated like this. So this is what unification will create in terms of unification process. The stack is then the top of the stack is disappeared. We don't care anymore about the references, because in the underlying heap we have already performed our changes. So this is what comes out of that. Okay. So this now is the remaining parts, in the sense of, well, we had this trail thing, which we used to record new bindings. We had backtrack, which was there before we would actually fail a unification, thus initiating backtracking here. And then there had been the check that performs the occur check, whether the variable occurs inside some term. And, well, depending on whether you are risky or not, you could just skip this, which is often done in concrete implementations. Or, is that? Yeah, and this is the actual check that can be done there. And this is, well, as you would assume, is just a run through the structure that is found in T. And, well, if this is an extra constructor thing, then we do the check on all its parameters. And if one of those fails, in the sense that the reference matches the variable that is given there, then we return false. Otherwise, we return true. So this is pretty straightforward. So the check is not particularly difficult to do. So this is what unification is in principle. With that, I want to terminate for today. Next time, we're going to have a look at how to distribute a load from the runtime to the code generation scheme a little bit by splitting up the actual unification process a little bit into parts that we can do with special purpose instructions, thus reducing a little bit the contention on the heap, and also kind of making the actual unification calls that happen during runtime a little bit less. So that's it for today. Have a nice week, and we'll see us again next week. Thank you.